You are listening to episode 13, the final episode of season 2 on the Conversations in the Gospel of John podcast. This podcast was recorded in the spring of 2024 at Fringe University. Welcome to Conversations in the Gospel of John, where we want to bridge the gap between current academic research and contemporary proclamation of this wonderful text. My name is Stan Harstein, and my co-host is Douglas Estes.
Hi, I'm Douglas. I teach at New College of Florida, and before that, I was a pastor for many years.
And I am at Fringe University, where we are recording this podcast today, and we want to thank you for choosing to listen to our conversation. Today, our guest is Dorothy Lee. Dorothy is at Trinity College, the University of Divinity in Melbourne, Australia. We are so glad to have her here today. So Dorothy, how would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Thank you, Stan. It's lovely to be here and to join both of you in this conversation. I teach New Testament. I've taught New Testament all my life, and I've had an interest in the Gospel of John all the way through. So that's my passion. So I do teaching, lecturing and research, but I'm also a member of the Anglican Church, I'm a priest in the church, and I'm attached to St. Paul's Cathedral in Melbourne, where I sometimes do things.
And we are recording this podcast the week after Easter, and some of the things you did were 7 sermons during the week of Easter, so quite an accomplishment, and we are so happy to have this conversation with you. We typically start by asking our guests what first got them interested in the Gospel of John, and each one of us has a different reason and a different history, so how do you respond to that, and where did you first get the Johannine fever, as we might call it?
Yes, it is a fever too. There's no one moment of sort of conversion, if you like, to John's gospel, but I've always loved stories. And John is obviously a story, so I've always been attracted to stories, but I love the literary qualities of John's gospel. I'm really drawn to the symbolism, the richness, the rich symbolism of the gospel. And I find it's in theology just incomparable. It's just deep and rich. And so having gone there, I've just never left.
Well, that's a good thing, because we haven't left either. And we hope our audience will continue to working on John, because we keep coming back to it and finding some new things. I think you mentioned that you like the literary element and the stories. There is a lot to narrative criticism. Do you have a particular tangent that you like to use as you're reading through the text that helps open the text for you, things that might be different than some of the other narrative critics who do character or plot or that sort of thing?
In the past, I've focused mainly on symbolism. That's what I originally looked at, the role that symbols play within specific narratives in John's gospel and how they interact and interwoven into the narrative, into the story, and the meaning that those symbols can have. You know, that there's never just a one-to-one correspondence. You know, Jesus is the light of the world has got one meaning and one meaning only. It doesn't. It has a number of associations. It doesn't mean you can, it means whatever you want it to mean. It is controlled, and it's controlled particularly by the Old Testament, by something of what we know of the environment of the ancient world, and it's controlled by the text of John itself. So it's controlled, but it's also, there's an openness about symbols. That's, I suppose, my main, I mean, I'm not alone in this. Some other wonderful people have written on the symbolism, and of course we all go back to Alan Culpepper for our understanding of the literary nature of John's gospel, but there are others working on the symbolism, and it's just, I enjoy reading other people and their takes on it, because they're going to be different from mine.
They are different. And as you said, there is some control, but there is a tremendous amount of openness. And that's what we like about narrative criticism, is we bring ourselves into the story, and what we've read from other people oftentimes has an impact on that. And so I think today what we're going to be looking at is the Lazarus-Mary anointing, the conflict that that brings about and how that might have some meaning that you've enjoyed working on lately and want to have a discussion with us. So let's begin by looking at John 12 and go ahead and tell us what the key idea you think is that you want to talk with us about today.
Well, I think the story of the anointing in John 12, it's verses 1 to 8, it's a story that's essentially about cost. I know it's a story about Mary, but Mary is in a way the secondary character because it's a story about Jesus, and it's about the cost that Jesus has paid for raising Lazarus. And I mean, the situation is that it's dangerous for him to go to Judea. He goes there. He raises Lazarus from the dead, and it results in many of the Jewish people coming to faith. And that leads the Jerusalem authorities to be very concerned about the fact that so many are flocking to Jesus. And so they form a plot to kill Jesus. Now, that's all the background. That's everything that's happened. And now we find them here at a banquet, a dinner party, in which that's what we'd call it in Australia. They're having a dinner party to celebrate, to honour Jesus for what he has done in restoring their brother. And Lazarus is there, which is really lovely because Lazarus has been a pretty passive character so far, having been first sick and then dead. And now he's been restored to life. And so it's a wonderfully happy occasion. It's a joyful occasion. It's celebratory. But yet the death of Jesus looms over it, because that's the price that Jesus has paid. And that becomes a metaphor then for, theologically, for the price that Jesus has paid to give us life. It's not just Lazarus who's loved by Jesus, but it's all of us who are loved by Jesus. And that's the price that Jesus has paid, according to John. It's really a story about the costliness of Jesus' action. But it's also about the response of true discipleship. The true disciple, who is symbolized by Mary herself, responds to the cost with her own cost. It's, in a sense, the giving of her life to Jesus through this incredibly expensive, costly, perfumed, scented oil that she pours over his feet. And therefore, we have a sense of what John elsewhere talks about, the mutuality between disciples and their Lord, the fact that that love is met with love, that love calls forth love. I think Mary is one example. There are others in the gospel, of course, there are quite a number of others. But Mary in this story is the example of the mutuality of discipleship.
And I think that gives us quite a bit to talk about today, but one of the things that always amazes me in our conversations is the interwoven pathways that we take. When we talk about the cost, the week prior to Palm Sunday, I was asked to preach, and I did a sermon on John 11. In doing that, answering the question, why does he weep so much? And I think what we're going to find today is that part of that is he's this transition of the stories between the two, that he knows what it will cost him to raise Lazarus from the dead. And then the fact that we'll talk about discipleships here in a minute.
I think we sometimes, you know, because we tend to say Mark's gospel focuses on the Gethsemane scene and the anguish of Jesus and take this cup from me. And in John's gospel, he doesn't say take this cup from me. But there's real signs of anguish in Jesus in John's gospel. And I think we forget them. You know, this notion that Jesus is not fully human is just seems to be not borne out by the text of John, that Jesus does experience anguish. And I find it interesting in John 12, when Jesus says, now my soul is troubled, and what am I to say? Father, save me from this hour. Our English translations say no, but there's no in the Greek. It says, but on account of this, for this hour, I've come. In other words, there's condensed in there a struggle. So there's no, and I think our English translations sometimes lead us astray. We lose the struggle because Jesus says immediately, no, I won't do that. But for this, Jesus is thinking aloud. But for this, hang on, I could say that. But on the other hand, I think we have to be careful to see what's actually there in the text of John. Jesus' tears, reference to him being anguished. We also find that in John 13.
Right. There's so much involved in that. And so as we we look at the transition, we can focus now on Mary and perhaps talk about her cost and her discipleship. So let's walk with our audience through how we see the cost of Mary. And it goes beyond the 300 denarii that the nard costs her. There's a lot more to that. And so how do you see that cost happening? And what type of donations does she have to make of herself in order to perform this anointing?
I think to answer that question, we have to start by saying who Mary is not. I mean, she's not the sinful woman of Luke 7, which occurs earlier in Jesus' ministry, nor is she the prophetic woman in Mark 14 who anoints Jesus' head in a prophetic anointing. And I think it's really important to kind of disentangle the strands there so that we can see John in the story in its own right. And I think from that point of view, Mary is, she's not a sinner. She's not Mary Magdalene, who's not a sinner anyway. And she is a disciple of Jesus. She's someone who is loved by Jesus. She's part of the Bethany family, loved by Jesus. And she first encounters him when he comes and on the way to the tomb, where she's accompanied by the mourners, and she falls at his feet in grief, in reproach. If you'd been here, my brother would not have died. There's grief and reproach in her first attitude to Jesus. There's an intense emotional response. And now we find her in John 12, again at Jesus' feet, but in a very, very different place. Now she's full of love and gratitude for what Jesus has done in restoring her brother. But I think it's more than that. I think there's a sense of mirroring here, that she mirrors the cost of what Jesus has done with her own cost. So it's not just 300 denarii, a year's wages for a laborer. It's actually something that symbolizes her whole self being poured out to Jesus. And there is in that a recognition of Jesus' death, that death will actually be the end result of this journey to Judea. And I think another factor is the smell at the open tomb of Lazarus. Martha says, don't open it. You know, there'll be a horrible smell. So you get the stench of death. But here you have perfume, you know, pervades the whole house. So now you get a sort of an aroma of life, actually, because the end of the story will be life, not death at all.
And I want to go back just a second to something you said, that her first encounter of Jesus is at the tomb, but that's actually the first recorded encounter of her. Because yes. We know from the text of John 11 that he already knows Lazarus and he already knows Mary, and he already knows Martha. They just haven't figured into the story. And I think that's one of the really important things when we're reading through John's gospel, is that oftentimes John knows a lot more than he's telling us. And he chooses at this point to bring this family into the story because they are the best examples, perhaps, of what he's trying to imply at that point in time. And that's one of those things that I noticed before, and I appreciate you clarifying, because we've talked about Mary several times, because a lot of people want to talk about Mary, that she is her own person, and church history and church interpretation has oftentimes morphed several women into the same, and John doesn't do that. He keeps them separate and really gives them their own individuality, which makes it even more important that she is now this paradigmatic disciple that we're going to look at. So, Douglas, do you have your question yet?
Yes. I want to, Dorothy, I want to take a moment to talk a little bit about symbolism in general for our audience, okay? So let me depict the problem, and then I'll ask the question. But the problem that I see is that if you're in a average church context, everyday life context, people have not spent a lot of time studying, you know, the Bible or symbolism and these kind of concepts. So tell us what makes symbolism in John nuanced and also so valuable for us to understand. Maybe define it and talk about how he nuances it and how it's valuable for us.
Thank you for asking me that very small question, Douglas.
Very small.
I think symbolism, this is a bit crude to say, put it like this, but we can distinguish symbols from signs. So a sign will point the way, but a symbol not only points the way, it actually takes us there. So it moves us and it affects us not just at an intellectual level, but at an affective level. So it engages us emotionally. And at least it's intended to. That's the intention of it. So symbols have content to them. They're not icing on the cake. They are the cake. You know, they're not the banana peel. They're the banana. So they're not meant to make the picture. It's not a spoonful of medicine of sugar to make the medicine go down. It's actually, symbols are, scholars talk about them as substantial. They have content to them. If we say Jesus is the light of the world, we are saying some very serious things about who Jesus is in terms of the Old Testament. So symbols have content to them, but they also engage us emotionally because we've all experienced what it's like getting up in the night and switching the light on. We know what light means and what a wonderful thing light is, and we can relate it to the sun. And so it engages us, the whole of ourselves. So symbols are really important, and religious symbols are particularly important because they say things, they make claims about who God is, about who Jesus is, about who we are. They don't just have a one-to-one correspondence, as you say. They can be very profound. They can mean different things to different people. It's interesting to get a group of people, parishioners perhaps, to sit down and say, what does light mean for you? What do you think of when you think of light? What's been your experience? And then to say, okay, how do you connect that to Jesus? What does that say to you about Jesus? And you'll find a number of different things will be said. The danger with symbolism is that, well, first of all, you can start seeing it everywhere. And one or two scholars have pointed out this, and it's probably a good reminder for people like me. The other thing is, so we need to be wary of that. The other thing is that symbols can't mean whatever you want them to mean. They are controlled. So there's an openness, but there's also a sort of area, a no-go area. And how do we know what that is? Well, John is very steeped in the Old Testament. And so when we look at something like light, we're going to look at, you know, light as the first thing that's created. We're going to look at the Torah, the law of Moses, as the light. Your word is a lamp to our feet, a light to our path. We're going to look at how light is understood in the ancient world. And then, of course, most importantly, we're going to look at how John uses it elsewhere in his gospel. The gospel itself is a control on our interpretation of symbols.
Great. So let's see if we can apply this, okay? So you correct me if I'm wrong and add to what I say. Here I am. I'm in a Bible study, you know, with local congregation right before Easter, and we're covering John 12, okay? We're reading this, and we realize, okay, Mary did this, Judas did this. From a dogmatic or historical critical perspective, that's what do you do with it beyond that, okay? But if we see the sacrifice of Mary on a deep, rich, symbolic level that applies to our life with discipleship, we're getting more into the heart of the text and what John wants.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. We're burrowing into the text, you know. We're allowing it to engage us, to speak to us. I think that what we encounter is ultimately the joy, the life of Jesus. That this story is essentially about life. And therefore the perfumed oil, the perfume pervading the house, is itself a symbol of that life. But it's life given through death.
I love what you're saying also about keeping Jesus as the protagonist of this episode, because clearly that's the role here. So it seems like to me that you have Jesus as the protagonist. You have Mary, who has the symbol of sacrifice, who, or maybe is the symbol of sacrifice. Okay. Then can we learn anything from Judas, who's like the reverse symbol?
Yes. I think there's a deliberate contrast, so we get the true disciple and the false disciple. At first glance, his objection, why wasn't this money sold? I mean, it's a device by John to emphasize the costliness, of course. But John won't allow it to stand for a moment. This is not a serious objection. This is not a discussion about social justice. That's not his concern here. Judas's objection is false. His words are not to be trusted. And why? Because he's a thief. I think what we can learn is that we cannot turn Judas into a tragic hero. John will not allow us to do that. And I know students often say to me in class, you know, but Judas, you know, that, you know, maybe he had motivation that was, you know, a higher motivation. But John says, no, there is no higher motivation. Judas is a thief. So John will not allow us to take Judas's objection seriously. And indeed, in John 13, he will go out of the room and John will say, and it was night. Now, that's not just a statement of fact. It is a statement of fact. It was night. But it's a statement that Judas has chosen darkness. And yet Judas has had his feet washed by Jesus. I mean, Jesus has died for Judas. Judas has been a beloved disciple of Jesus, and yet he chooses darkness rather than light. Perhaps what John 12 does is present us with a choice. Which way do we go? Do we go towards the light and the perfume and the cost, even though it's painful, which is essentially the way to life? Or do we take the apparent pious route of concern for the poor, which is in fact a cover for our own darkness? And do we choose darkness? So I think perhaps as you speak, it just occurs to me that we are given a choice here of two disciples. How will we respond to what Jesus has done?
Let me shift gears and ask a question. But let's say there's a pastor who wants to, you know, he's thinking about a sermon series that he wants to do and thinks, you know, let's do something. It'd be really cool to do something symbolism. We can do something symbolism in John because there's light and darkness and, you know, I can tie it into Star Wars or something, you know. What would be the warning that you might give so that there's no chance of the pastor going off the rails and turning it into symbolism for symbolism's sake? I know you mentioned the controls of the Old Testament, but I'm wondering if there's any other controls too.
I think one of the controls is John's theology. Again, it's back to the fact that symbols are not decorations. They have substance to them. And so the question is, what does the symbol reveal about who Jesus is, who God is? I think symbolism without theology is just impossible. We need the theology, or the spirituality is another word, if you can cope with that word.
I think that's great, because I think in the U.S., I'll speak from the U.S. context, there's a temptation or tendency in some segments of the church to focus on the exciting part. You know, like, let's throw out some ideas about symbols. It'll be really exciting, interesting to people, light and darkness. But if it's not rooted in John's theology, then it goes off track. Well, even if it doesn't seem at first like it's going to go off track, it's going to go off track because it doesn't have that theological basis.
Yeah, which means it doesn't have the depth, you know, and in the end of the day, it's failed the symbolism itself. It's not allowed to, so the symbolism, John's symbolism takes us to a very deep place. We end up face to face with God. We see the face of God in Jesus. That's what we see. And we see something of ourselves in some of the characters like Judas or like Caiaphas. I mean, these are the real baddies, but in other characters too, we see something of ourselves. So the gospel is both a revelation of the face of Jesus and of the face of God and who God really is and what God is like and what John means by glory, which is so central, this radiant presence of God. This is what God is like. If we do not end up coming face to face with God and with our true selves and the nature of our world, then the symbolism has just been play acting.
You mentioned two people, Caiaphas and Judas. Is there symbolism in Martha's confession in John 11 and Mary's symbolic act of wiping the feet that has a deeper meaning, perhaps, that causes Caiaphas and Judas to sort of dissipate in the light, that they bring this light, perhaps, in the confession, and the falseness of these others dissipates? Do you see any symbolism in there, or even doesn't have to be symbolic, but theology of John in lifting up these two ladies at this point in time, as we know it's preparation for death?
Yes, I think that's good. And I've never seen it quite so sharply, that you've got the two women, Mary and Martha, and then you've got Judas and Caiaphas, both within the same story. I know that people disagree on the nature of her confession, but it seems to me that Martha's confession, in response to Jesus saying, "I am the resurrection and the life," that confession, Martha's confession in word, paralleled by Mary's confession in deed. So you've got word and action together, forming the one confession about who Jesus is. Now, Martha hasn't fully understood. She's on a journey. She gets to the tomb and she says, no, don't open it. And Jesus says, "Did I not tell you that," you know, which as a matter of fact, he doesn't literally say, but is implied. So I think, you know, as in the synoptic gospels, the confession, thou art the Christ, you are the Messiah, is made by Peter. In John's gospel, it's made by Martha. Now, of course, Peter makes his own confession in chapter 6 in John. You know, you have the words of eternal life. But here the confession is made by Martha, by Martha of Bethany. So Mary and Martha do actually contrast. But we find her serving at this meal, which suggests perhaps a resolution for her of her doubts earlier. But yes, they do contrast markedly. They show the true nature of discipleship, which confesses who Jesus is in words, but also in action as well, in loving action.
That's pretty, pretty important. So we're coming to the end of our time on our recording. Are there any other tidbits in your thought process on this little passage that you want to make sure you share with us? Any final words for our listeners?
Can I say two things?
You could say two things.
First of all, I would say that Mary's action prefigures the foot washing. So it anticipates the foot washing. So Jesus, who washes the disciples' feet, much to Peter's horror, and that the foot washing is, you know, very much about being in union with Jesus, I think primarily. We always read it as, you know, it's all about serving others. Well, it is, but that's the secondary meaning. That's an implication. You know, unless I wash you, you have no part with me. You have no share with me, I think is the essence of the foot washing. And that has already been anticipated by Mary, who in a sense, metaphorically speaking, washes Jesus' feet. That is one thing. The other thing that I think is important is to confirm the capacity of women to be disciples, to be leaders in the church today. That gives us a chance, I think, to challenge, although John's not, that's not his context, but it is our context, and to challenge the notion that only men can lead, only men can be exemplary disciples. So I think John, as we read it today, can challenge some of that sort of patriarchal view that church leadership, whether in the home or in the home of the church, is only for men.
Douglas?
No, that's great. I appreciate everything that you added, Dorothy.
Thank you.
One of the good things is when we come to an end, we don't have any more questions. We want to thank you, Dorothy, for joining us in this Conversations in the Gospel of John. And we want to thank our listeners for taking time to listen to this. And we hope that they have a new sense of the power of symbolism and start to use that in their own lives, because the Gospel of John is not a scientific experiment. It is not a mathematical formula. It is a story with a great deal of depth, and that's always something for us to recognize. So thank you for joining us today.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed this. I'm totally awake now, even though it's early morning for us in Australia. Well, relatively early. I've really enjoyed our discussion. It's really been very stimulating, and I look forward to meeting you at some point.
Well, we hope that'll be soon. Thank you.
Well, that brings season 2 of Conversations in the Gospel of John to an end. We thank you for listening, and we hope to hear from you. You can email us at cgj@stanharstein.com. Thank you.